everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. Hey, you're listening to It's All About Food, and it's 11, 12, 13. What? It's November 12th, 2013. I just realized this morning when I was writing it, 11, 12, 13. That's always fun to play with the numbers. When is that going to happen again? Well, maybe another 1,000 years. Anyway, it's a very refreshing day out today. We had a little snow here in New York City, and I'm loving it. It's cool and crisp. I just came back from a wonderful run. In fact, I almost got here a little too late because I was so wrapped up in the wonderful experience. Somehow, with the cold, it just makes the running more pleasant. You don't really realize you're sweating, and I just felt like I was floating. It was really delicious. So I'm all lubricated and ready to go, and I want to bring on my first guest. Now, this show is called It's All About Food, and sometimes I step out of the box a little bit and expand on my concept of what food is, and today it's food for the soul. How about that? We're going to be talking with David Christopher, who has a new book called The Holy Universe, A New Story of Creation for the Heart, Soul, and Spirit. David Christopher left behind corporate and airline careers to pursue his passion for exploring the answers to humanity's eternal question of our place in the universe and to help bring forth a new story for our turbulent times. For the past 15 years, he has immersed himself in the works of scientists and thinkers such as Brian Swim, Thomas Berry, Elizabeth Sartoris, James Lovelock, big historians such as David Christian, and many others. The dialogues within the Holy Universe are an outgrowth of this study, as well as his work with the Pachamama Alliance's Awaking the Dreamer, Changing the Dream Symposium. He wrote the book in part for people like him who call themselves spiritual but not religious, who are trying to make sense of craziness going on in the world and who seek a meaningful path through the global crises we collectively face. David, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, you're welcome, Karen. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay, so I already let you know that I read your book and loved your book. Thank you for writing it.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you. I appreciate the kudos.
And reading your bio, I am definitely one of those spiritual but not religious people. I say that a little too often on this program. I don't want to offend people, but, you know, I have certain feelings about things, and spiritual but not religious really describes where I'm coming from. okay, so I don't want to tell the whole story of this book. It's something that I think everyone needs to read. And what I liked about it is there are so many messages in here that I'm familiar with in my own quest and journey, but you've packaged it in such a lovely way that it was good to meet these concepts again, see them in a different light, remind myself of the work that I'm going on. It was just delightful. I can't say enough about it. I think I need to read it again. But there's definitely a lot of work that went into putting this together.
Well, thank you. Yes, it ended up taking about 7 years to write, even though it's actually a little bit smaller than most books, if you to go by the word count. It took quite a while to really choose the right wording and make the story the story of the seeker and the sage, as well as the story of creation that's within the story of those two, really work well without being something that turned into something you would be bogged down by. I really didn't want something like that.
Okay, so just so people know what we're talking about in this book, can you just give a little synopsis of it?
Sure, sure. What it is, it's a recasting of the modern scientific evidence that we've collected about the origins of the universe. And it recasts it, it transforms it into a more metaphorical and lyrical story of creation that's based on those scientific facts. But the story itself is really reminiscent of the stories that we've told ourselves through the ages. It's reminiscent of the scriptures that I grew up with. And this story, this modern creation story, is told through this dialogue between a seeker and a sage. And the sage tells the story of the universe, tells the story from the beginning of the universe to the creation of galaxies, the creation of stars, planets, life, to the emergence of humanity, and all the way to the crises we now face today. And then it gets into what this evolutionary story has to teach us about these crises and how we might find our way through them, and in fact how these crises might be the best thing that ever happened to humanity. So that's it kind of in a nutshell. It takes a rather broad sweep of things.
Well, what I like about it is a lot of things I like about it, but one is it doesn't give us a direct answer because we can't possibly know all the answers that are out there. The world is a mystery, and you use that word frequently.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But you present it in a way where we can almost understand that there is some logic or meaning in all of it.
Or intelligence.
Intelligence, so that we don't feel like it's just a random act.
We're all here. Yeah, and actually, you know, what jumps to my mind, it's sort of like, you know, and your show is obviously very focused on food and right eating, and you can't be completely proscriptive to every person, and at a certain point, each person has to listen to their own body, and just as that, when they're trying new foods and figuring out what works for my body, which may not work for another person's body. And I think not being proscriptive is important. I mean, you need to have some guidance as far as here are some directions we can go. But really, the evolutionary process is all about experimentation of what works here. Let's try this. That worked. That didn't work. And I didn't want to leave people entirely hanging with nothing. But I also, as you point out, I don't think it's very, very useful to be completely proscriptive of here are the seven things we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of information out around that, and I didn't really have a need to add to that. I wanted to add a different slant on it, a different facet of the whole story.
There have been some other books that I've read that when I finished them, it just gave me this feeling of peace, like your book did, just a peaceful feeling that, oh, it's all okay. And you do mention that there are all kinds of violent things that go on in life, and and that life includes birth and death and good things and violent things, and it's a balance. But still, it left me with this feeling of it's all okay. And there were other books that I've read, I remember, that kind of described patterns that we see in life where I think you even described it to some extent where at a microscopic level we see how cells join together and they become larger beings through cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then as it gets larger and larger, we see the same thing at a macroscopic level where people form together in a cooperative way and form cities and states.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these books have even said that the Earth itself is trying to cooperate together as one unit so that it can join the planets in some form of cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that echoes James Lovelock theory, the Gaia theory, that the biosphere itself is a living organism, and it certainly behaves like a living organism. And I also hate to use that term necessarily, because sometimes when, you know, the language we use is very important. I mean, organism starts to sound kind of objectified. Maybe a better word is being, that Earth herself is, that the web of life, that Gaia is a living being. And as a result, it's quite possible there's some intentionality behind that. That to me is part of the mystery and part of the discovery on my own spiritual path too.
Now, another thing you mentioned somewhere in here is the importance of both science and intuition.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Because a lot of science will want us to just trash intuition, but I think they're both very important.
Well, yeah, and there's interesting, there was actually a very interesting article I read recently about, it's something that has to be developed, because our intuitions can also, just as the facts can mislead us, our intuitions can lead us too. And, but it is important to develop both, the folks, those of us who were strict materialist atheists, will bristle at some of the anthropomorphization I've done, and it's the suggestion of, you know, that as birds having an evolutionary story that they're telling themselves. And there's a part of me that bristles at it, too, and yet there's the other side of me and my own teachings with my own work with my own teacher, that there is something really astonishing going on that science has yet to discover and may never discover. And that part of the mystery is something that I can't discount, and I cannot simply say, well, that's just an imagining, or that's just merely a physiological side effect of a physical brain, and that's really all it is. One particular point that I thought that hit me yesterday was, if we have certain experience that we would call spiritual or transcendent, and a strict scientific interpretation looks at it only as just a simple byproduct of the brain, and that's just the way what it does. There's really nothing more to it than that. And the question that I want to ask is, why? Why would evolution spend so much time to create a brain that takes a lot of energy, that then has this ability to perceive the world in such non-ordinary states of reality? There's something happening here that is really that is worth investigating and worth pursuing.
I think so. I think something's happening here. Now, the story, as you mentioned before, is about a seeker, which is just like your regular contemporary guy today. He's married, he's got a family, and he's kind of depressed. He, in the beginning of the book, he's lost his job,
and he's also lost his way, yeah.
And his way. You know, a lot of times we read or hear about how you really need to pursue what it is you're here on the planet for.
Mm-hmm.
And you may be in a job that doesn't feel good to you, but many of us are so stuck, and many people are unemployed and struggling to get work, mm-hmm. that it seems impossible to be able to have the luxury even to pursue this sort of work.
Well, yeah, and that's true. And one thing that I think we all should be mindful of and be careful of is that we are in a superstructure, a society, a culture that doesn't quite know how to pay us to do the work that really needs to be done.
Yep.
And there's actually a piece of that in the piece talking about that in the book, that we, and I was actually talking with another person a few months ago about how she's really struggling to create a business that really sings to her, but, you know, here she is, she's turning 40, she's had to move back into her parents' house, mm-hmm. because she just can't afford it. And I said, well, you know, you have to remember, don't beat yourself up. You're in a culture that doesn't know how to pay you to do this work. This culture rewards things that tend to be, not everything, but a lot of the great rewards go to people who are doing things that really are, and unintentionally so in a lot of cases, that really are destructive to the web of life and to Earth. So we haven't figured it out yet. So that's certainly one of the things that I talk about. I touch on it in the book, and also that I talk with in some of the work that I do, is to help people say, all right, well, how do you find yourself? What is the work that calls to you, and how do you make it work within the context and not just what calls to your heart, but also in the real context of the economy that you're in and what it wants, whether or not it really is a positive thing for it to want or a life-affirming thing it wants. You have to pay attention to both, and you have to make your life work in that regard too.
I guess another thing is changing your perspective about things. And you have this example of the man who's the seeker, who's annoyed when he gets home and there's dishes in the sink and his wife didn't clean them, and, you know, he's all bent out of shape, why didn't she clean the dishes? And at some point he realizes, you know, why is he spending so much energy getting angry? It's so trivial. He should just clean the dishes himself, and everything will be fine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and just to clarify, too, they did have an agreement between the two of them that she was responsible for the dishes. It's not like he was expecting, oh, this is women's work.
Sure.
It's just, yeah, this was her agreement, and she broke it. And yet, yes, how he finds himself, this is an important part. He finds himself going back into old personal stories about how the world should be, and he starts spinning into this negative whirlpool of how he is in the world. And the important thing and the important lesson is that he stops himself and says, what am I thinking? What am I doing here? And in that stopping, it's that I think is an important lesson, is that is stopping oneself in the midst of a story that you're telling yourself about how bad this is or how wrong this is. And then stopping it and then choosing another story and then moving on from there. I mean, the two of them talk it out afterwards, and they come to another understanding. She apologizes and they move on, rather than going into a whole fight over the whole thing. And even though it's a small, not that earth-shaking kind of conflict, it really is, it's an important way of demonstrating how one can be in the world that can then be carried on into the rest of the work that they do.
There are just so many things, if we just stop for a moment, mm-hmm. and just change the channel or change the story
yes.
or take that tape out, and it feels better. You talk about it too, where you remember something that angered you and your body gets all tense and angry, and then you remember something good that mm-hmm. happened, and it gives you relief, and it's really a simple exercise but very powerful when you realize how quickly you can shift your emotion.
Yes, yes, yeah, that's one of the exercises that the sage gives to the seeker. And yes, it's very simple, and yet, you know, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners do, it's not necessarily an easy thing to do.
No.
I have spent so much time in very logical, heady, analytical kinds of careers that that part of my psyche is very, very strong and well developed, and I've learned that it's a little too overdeveloped, and it's, you know, that part of my own path is to learn how to quiet that part and reawaken the heart and the more intuitive sides of myself.
Now, how is it you were able to leave the corporate world to pursue your passion?
At a certain point, I had no choice. I was reading, I remember there were a couple of incidents. But let me just tell you about one where I was at I was at the corporate gym in the Bay Area, in San Francisco Bay Area, and I was working out on the Stairmaster and looking out at this beautiful, beautiful view across the bay. And I was reading a book called In the Absence of the Sacred by a man named Jerry Mander, and it talks about the failure of technology and the survival of the indigenous nations across the world. And I remember reading it and realizing that, my God, I am part of the machine that is tearing up this planet. And the thing is that I didn't have any intention to do that, and nobody around me had no intention to do that. That's not what they were trying to do, and yet that's what we were doing. And at a certain point, I just realized, I can't do this anymore. I have to stop. And I just really left. And wandered for a bit and got a little lost. And it really wasn't until I got connected with what you had mentioned before, the Pachamama Alliance. It's a rainforest NGO in San Francisco. And in one of the programs they have, they tell this new story of creation. Hmm. So I was just kind of bopping along and trying, you know, as a lot of people do, with no real underlying story of creation that sang to me. And as I discovered that, I loved it. I lapped it up. And as you know, it was about 15, 20 years ago that I started studying this material and really in absorbing it like a sponge. And that's what led finally to creating the book, because there was a part of me that also wanted not just the non-fictional scientific information that talked about a universe that seems mysteriously creative. I wanted to tell the story in a story format. So that really was the beginning of the book about 7 years ago, 8 years ago.
Is there something wrong with technology?
Well, as Jerry Mander says, there are consequences to technology. Every technology has positive and negative social and political consequences. And the idea that technology is neutral is a mantra that modern mind tells itself. that, you know, it isn't the problem with technology. And yet, if you think about, say, you know, the example in the book uses nuclear technology. If we decide to have nuclear technology, the social and political consequences are that you need to have a strong central government to take care of the dangerous material. You need to have an elite cadre of scientists. It is an inherently a centralized system. Positive or negative, it depends on the value judgment of the society. But if that's what you want to do, then those are the consequences. You have to have a centralized, strong force to take care of it, versus more dispersed technologies such as solar or wind. They don't have that need for central control. They don't have that need for central protection. So, yes, I mean, and this is just a quick example, but all technology has positive and negative consequences that we rarely even speak about, much less acknowledge.
Yep.
And that, I think, needs to be part of our conversation as we decide how are we going to get through the times ahead.
Don't get me started with smartphones.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yes. Yeah, they're a little too smart, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I don't know what kind of story we're creating with smartphones where people aren't talking to each other and focusing
yes.
on a machine all the time.
Yes, and they're very, very, what is the word? They're very attractive. They're very, what is that word? That they just kind of beckon at you. There's like a siren calling at you. Oh, just check one more email.
Yeah, you always think that there's more there that I have to check, but it's addictive.
Yes.
So what I would like to see is that people, children, grow up with a story like this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to knock some of the other things that people read with their religious upbringing, but some of it is, I think it's debilitating in some ways. People are raised with guilt. They're not empowered. And
mm-hmm.
a story like this will give children the feeling that even though the world can be scary at sometimes and powerful, we all have within us great things to make a positive difference in the world, to be creative and to do good.
Yes, and also too that we are very much a part of and connected to the cosmos and the planet. I have a little 30-second excerpt I can read if you'd be interested.
Yes, please.
Well, this occurs towards the end of the book. It's the last part of the dialogues, and the seeker and the sage are at the beach after sunset. And the sage is talking, similar to what you were just talking about, the sage is talking about the temple of the infinite, talking about coming out of our houses of worship and finding our temples everywhere outside. And as the sage is talking about this, the seeker is pondering, are we really going to wake up in time to face all the crises that we face? So the sage responds, I think we will. As I sit here in this temple and look out at the decorated sky, listening to the chorus of waves and shorebirds, I remember. I remember that the infinite has been driving itself to greater order and beautiful complexity, to greater consciousness for billions of years. I remember I am bathing in this cosmic stream that carries me on this delightful journey. I remember that we are much larger than we think. We are not meaningless specks on an insignificant planet in a vast, heartless universe. We are instead dazzling flashes of brilliance on a tiny but delightful, sacred sparkle of stardust called Earth. The infinite could not be 1 millimeter smaller and still be able to call us into being. The universe worked patiently for billions upon billions of years to create us. There is a place for you in the universe, a place for you in the web of life. You never were separate from the infinite. She fell silent once again, and they sat basking in the starlight.
Doesn't that make you feel good?
Yes.
Well, it makes me feel good. That's like a nice little prayer to read every day.
Yes, and it also, too, one thing it also reveals, too, that the sage is a woman.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That
I fell for it. I fell in the trap.
It's revealed earlier on, but
yeah.
not right at the beginning of the book, that there's this conversation, and the personal pronoun she doesn't show up until page 15. And a lot of my readers and a lot of people who read this have that sudden shock or just kind of jarring realization that, oh, I was seeing two men.
Yeah.
I wasn't seeing the sage as a woman.
And I thought that too, but I guess part of what led me to that is that they met at a party, and the fact that the seeker's wife was encouraging him to see the sage, it made me more automatically think it was a man than a woman, mm-hmm. because so many people in partnerships, you know, don't want to encourage a one-on-one relationship with mm-hmm. a man with a woman.
Well, and it's even bigger than that too, because the issues that we're facing, that the ecological issues we're facing, are very much related to the social justice issues that we're facing.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the underlying worldview that is causing problems in each sphere of our societies really have to do with the same worldview. That is one that's really based on dominance, on control, on the whole story of modern mind, that we are separate from the earth and we can do whatever we wish to the web of life without consequence. And we're learning very hard lessons right now that that's not the case. And, you know, a worldview that sees a nature, a web of life where we can just do whatever we want without consequence, we can just throw things away, has a similar view that there are certain people we can just throw away. That's just the way it is for some people in our society. They're just throwaway people. So it's very much a related worldview.
I remember I was raised in a Jewish upbringing, and I remember being in Hebrew school and learning about the Bible. And one of the things that one of my teachers was sharing with us that he thought was so important in the development of humanity was the fact that when Abraham realized there was one God, there was this development of the individual where people started to think more about themselves and who they were rather than the community as a whole. And in reflecting on that, I think, although, you know, it's good to think about yourself, I think we lost that. That was the beginning of the end of the connection with each other, other beings, life on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, the sage actually talks about three minds: ancient mind, which is what emerged as we emerged as a species about 50 to 100,000 years ago, depending on which scientists you adhere to. And then 10,000 years ago, as we got really smart about agriculture and took advantage of some very positive climate change, we started settling into cities and villages, villages that became cities that soon became chiefdoms and then empires. And the story there really was one of separation, that humanity is separate from the universe and separate from the cosmos and separate from the web of life and even separate from each other. That we started seeing one another as very much more and more divided up into families and then individuals, and that really got going about 200 or 300 years ago with the Enlightenment and the Renaissance in Europe, and that idea of separation really was taken to an extreme with the mechanistic dead view of the universe. So there is value in recognizing who I am as an individual, but there's a lot of value that we lost in that I think we have to regain in seeing ourselves as part of a community, you know, a community of people, a community of species, and even a community of the cosmos, really.
You have a little chapter or section on the seed, which I really enjoyed. I find seeds fascinating. And I think we're supposed to find seeds fascinating because they keep us going. They enable things to grow that we can consume, and it's one of these lovely circles of life. And it's scary today with technology how we're kind of losing control of necessary seeds for so many foods. But you created a nice analogy with all of us as individuals and seeds, and there may be thousands and thousands of seeds, but only one will grow into a plant.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But they're all important.
Yes. If you didn't have all the seeds, from everywhere, even if you look at the cosmos, if we didn't have the many seeds of stars out there, then a star like our sun would not be able to create a planet that can wherein life can emerge. So, you know, the universe seeds itself with billions of galaxies, and galaxies seed themselves with billions of stars, and the stars seed themselves with billions of planets. So that idea of seeding goes all the way back to the beginning of all beginnings. And it kind of echoes the saying in the Christian Bible, many are called, but few are chosen. And that's an interesting concept because you need the many need the chosen, the few need the all. Otherwise, the chosen, those who are chosen to grow, they wouldn't find those places to flourish. And that echoes back into the idea of experimentation. You know, let's throw a whole bunch of seeds into the landscape and let's see what happens. Let's see what happens when those seeds interact with the seeds of other plants. Let's experiment. That's sort of that intelligence that the web of life carries as it evolves.
So we don't all need to be celebrities.
No.
although a lot of people want to be, especially with Facebook.
Yeah, and unfortunately that's part of our culture is that, you know, if you're not somebody, you're a nobody.
You're a nobody.
And that's a horrible thing to foist on a population.
Yep. We're all living with that today.
And part of it too is and this is actually a challenge for myself too, is that if my efforts fail, how do I keep that, you know, how do I make that part of my life without making me the failure?
Mm-hmm.
For all the startups that you hear about where people are successful, there are many, 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 many more that have failed in business. And we don't hear about that. We don't hear about the 8 or 9 efforts that a venture capitalist firm will fund that don't go anywhere. We only hear about the 1 or 2 in 10 or the 1 or 2 in 100 that make it and support all the – and basically what those that make it do, they support those that fail. And you need those that fail because we don't know which ones are going to succeed. So it's a really difficult lesson to learn that if something I do doesn't work out, how do I be in the world without feeling like, oh my God, I'm a failure? So that's just what the web of life does.
You're not a failure. You're a part of the mystery.
You're part of
the process.
You're part of the entire process.
And yeah. So enjoy it. Enjoy failing.
Yes.
it's the work, right?
Yes, it's part of the work, it's not necessarily very simple, but not necessarily easy too.
Okay, now that this book has come out, what's next for you, David Christopher?
This book it takes a lot of time to bring a book out, and I'm going to be focusing on just simply, you know, talking about it more. I'm traveling up to Bellingham and Vancouver next week to visit some Unitarian churches, and I've actually had some very interesting attention from folks who are from Catholic traditions. Thomas Berry was a Catholic theologian, and Sister Miriam McGillis down in New Jersey has a farm called Genesis Farm, and there are many other places, little pockets here within the Catholic faith that is really looking at this new story and saying, how do we integrate this into our belief? And it's a very fine line because, you know, they have to be very careful how they approach it, because there is this very traditional and conservative interpretation of the scriptures that one has to be gentle with, shall we say.
Yep.
So I'm finding the book really landing in places like New Thought churches, such as Centers for Spiritual Living and Unity churches and Unitarian Universalist churches, and even some of the more liberal Christian churches.
Wow.
There's this whole side of Christianity that doesn't get enough attention, called emergent Christianity, which is really setting aside all these focus on the social issues and saying, you know, what is really the message here? The message is about helping people. The message is about service. The message is about taking care of those who are sick or hurt. That's really what we should be focusing on, rather than the things we have been focusing on. And I have been surprised at how much that I've gotten some interest in those kind, those people from who, those of us who hail from those kinds of faiths. So that really is what's next, is let's go see where, you know, again, experimenting, and let's go see where this message wants to be heard.
I like that. The last thing it just made me think about is, again, I'm not sure where it came in the book, but about change and how things aren't the same and they're meant to change. And, oh, gosh, I wish I could remember. I think I dog-eared it, but maybe you know where I'm going with this. But as we evolve, things continually change. They're not meant to be the same, and it's all...
Yes, well, that's part of the whole idea of the opposite of death is not life. The opposite of death and is birth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because birth and death are the two sides of life's, you know, the infinite's primordial drive toward life. I mean, life needs both in order to continue to experiment. You have to let go of the old forms so that new forms can emerge. Which so it may be that that's what you're alluding
yeah.
to, and it's hard because there's also
yeah.
part of us that really, you know, too much change and too much letting go can really be damaging to one's psyche. So, but it has to happen. So that's part of some of the painful process of life, is letting go of old forms and letting go of people and letting go of old institutions and that sort of thing, and we will cling to them. If we have no other story to take its place, we will cling to them and get ourselves into trouble.
Yeah, we see that in so many ways, people clinging to things that they really should be letting go of. Mm-hmm. They don't even realize how detrimental it is to themselves and to everyone else. Oh, humanity.
Yeah.
Okay, one last question before I let you go. This show is called It's All About Food, and I just wondered, what's your favorite food?
Oh, Lord. Food that is cooked well. And cooked with intention and cooked with love.
Love is a great ingredient.
And happiness and maybe even a little wine thrown in during the preparation. It really, and that's not just a fanciful thing, too. And that's one of my own challenges. A lot of us have not grown up with that feeling of food or that attitude towards food. So when food is prepared that well with that intention, there's something magical that happens, and it makes for a much better experience for everyone in the preparing and the eating, even in the cleaning up, if it's wonderful food.
That sounds good to me. I love that, and I wholeheartedly agree.
Uh-huh.
Eat food that's made with love.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
David Christopher, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. I love The Holy Universe. I think I'm going to read it again very soon. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me on.